This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last night in New York, the Mets relinquished leads of 3-0, 4-2, and 6-4, eventually losing to the Cardinals 9-6 on a ninth-inning home run by So Taguchi. The St. Louis win evened the National League Championship Series at one game apiece. The Cardinals and Mets will play Game 3 tonight in St. Louis, where the Mets will send Steve Traxel to the mound to face Jeff Suppan. Earlier yesterday, the Detroit Tigers proved to be the better cold-weather team. They lead the A's 3-0 in the American League Championship Series thanks to another splendid performance from starting pitcher Kenny Rogers, who is now working on a streak of 15 consecutive scoreless innings. Rogers shut out Oakland for 7 1/3 innings last night. The final score in that game was 3-0. Detroit can close out the series and secure a place in the World Series by beating Oakland in Detroit this afternoon. Joining me now to talk about Tigers present and past is Michael Rosenberg. He's a columnist with the Detroit Free Press. Michael, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
With a record of 43 wins and 119 losses back in 2003, the Tigers were perhaps the worst team in the history of the American League, but the 2006 Tigers are on the verge of making it to the World Series. Everybody knew this team had some talent, but are fans having a little bit of a hard time believing the turnaround?
Let's not forget that was a stirring final week rally to get to 43 and 119 that year. They were actually worse. Yeah, I think people are surprised because it was, they made progress the next year and then really didn't make progress last year, and nobody expected this. It's one of those things where you don't even hear about it as a media person for not picking them to win because nobody is going to claim that they thought they would do it. Even Leland says he didn't expect this, but here they are.
This season has had a great deal of volatility as well. The Tigers were the best team in the majors through the summer, and then they slumped so badly in the fall it looked like they might not even make the playoffs. Now they're the best team in the majors again. How about instead of suffering from disbelief, fans are just exhausted?
Yeah, they are. You know, they finally, when fans started to buy in July, said, okay, they can't blow it. And then you're like, they're starting to blow it. They're blowing it. It's clearly getting blown now. And then all of a sudden they kind of righted the ship toward the end there. And to the credit of the guys on the team, I mean, they were resilient. They never doubted themselves. The clubhouse never seemed tight to me. There were just times they weren't playing well.
A lot of young kids. I remember talking to the Tigers a little earlier this season. I got the impression that some of these guys didn't know how to get tight and blow it. It was too new to them.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, Joel Zamaya, for example, the rookie reliever who's injured at the moment, he's about as loose as they come. He just goes out there and throws literally as hard as he can. It's kind of fun to watch. It's sort of like one of those swim to the end of the pool races they have in the Olympics. they're having a good time.
Usually the importance of a new manager is overrated, but in the case of Jim Leland, maybe it's been underrated, if that's possible. Can we say the Tigers' turnaround is primarily due to his influence, or is that an exaggeration?
Well, I'm always hesitant to say primarily, and I think he would probably stop me if I did. One difference between this team is that he does have a couple of players they didn't have. He has Kenny Rogers, he has Verlander, he has Zamaya, even Todd Jones that they didn't have last year. So it is a different team to some degree. Maglio Ordóñez was healthy all year. But having said that, I mean, the clubhouse last year just seemed like guys could not wait to get out of it. And what's interesting is they've got a lot of the same guys, and all of a sudden they like being around each other. So if that doesn't tell you the manager makes a difference, I don't know what does.
Players I've talked to who have been managed by Jim Leland have said that his great strength is that he commands not only attention but respect. People pay attention to everything he says and never doubt that he's telling them the right things. How does somebody get that kind of credibility?
Well, you know, he's really sincere, and they kind of realized that early on, that he wasn't going to play games, he wasn't going to treat the superstars, you know, with he wasn't going to be scared of him, you know? He wasn't going to treat him with kid gloves. He was going to go up there. He went up to Pudge Rodriguez very early, probably the biggest name in the team, and said, look, you know, this is how we're going to do things here, because Pudge was a major problem last year, and he's not been at all a problem this year. And, you know, the fact that he's won a World Series and has been around so long certainly gives him credibility, because most of the guys in his team don't have any of that kind of credibility to themselves.
Well, younger listeners may know Detroit as a hockey town with the Red Wings' success, but the Tigers have a long and storied baseball tradition, albeit not much of a recent one. They took a beating for 19 years since the last time they made the playoffs. So is the Motor City a baseball city again now?
You know what it is? It's a great sports town, and it's kind of a winning town. And that hockey town stuff was largely marketing by the Red Wings, but also because the Red Wings, for a good stretch of the 90s, were the only good team. People don't believe me when I tell them this, but the most popular team in town, all records being equal, is the Lions. And if the Lions ever got really good, which is due to happen in 2173, then the town will go nuts. But right now, the Tigers are the number one story. Red Wings are actually probably fourth, and just a few years ago, they were clear number one.
It was such a joyous celebration at Comerica Park after the Tigers eliminated the Yankees in the divisional series last weekend that it's hard to imagine that even a collapse in the league championship series would ruin this season. Have I got that about right?
I think you have it right. Of course, if they build a 3-0 lead in the World Series and then blow it, I think people will remember that. But overall, this is a successful year no matter what, and I think that's partly why they celebrated against the Yankees, and it's kind of good for them to celebrate because they can just be loose and go out there and play knowing full well that whatever they do, their season exceeded everyone's expectations.
It's hard to think about next year at this point, things being as exciting as they are in the present, but is this a team that's built for the long haul, or is this going to turn out to be a fluke?
Well, I think the franchise is built for the long term. I think this particular roster is going to change more significantly than some people realize by next year. I mean, the best thing you can have in baseball, as we know, is young pitching, and they probably have more of it, including at the major league level, than any team in baseball. So for that reason, I think they'll be around a while. Having said that, they don't really have those middle-of-the-lineup guys that you need, and I think they're going to make some sort of move in the offseason, either left field, first base, maybe even third base, to try to get one of those guys who's a 35-40 home run guy. Kind of like the White Sox did last year when they brought Tomey in, and of course then they missed the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So who knows if that's the right idea, but I think that's what they'll try to do.
Of course, the rest of baseball, and especially the rest of the American League, is sore as heck at the Tigers right now because they've made the Yankees so mad that George Steinbrenner will probably buy every available decent free agent.
You know, it's about time he starts spending money, don't you think? Really, enough of this, penny pinching on his part. At this point, I'm going to pretend I can throw and see if he offers me a few mil.
Michael Rosenberg is a columnist and an aspiring pitcher, apparently, working temporarily for the Detroit Free Press. Michael, thanks again.
Thanks so much.
The Cardinals have been the NFL's laughingstock for more than 50 years. That was all supposed to change this season when the team, which has been in Arizona since 1988, moved into a futuristic new stadium with a state-of-the-art retractable field. But after a 1-4 start, Cardinals fans, who for the first time obliged ownership by purchasing every seat for every home game this season, may also be ready to retract. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Steve Goldstein reports.
The National Football League embraces parity. Former Commissioner Pete Rozelle was convinced that if every team had an equal chance of winning, the league would be healthier. The Arizona Cardinals seem to have missed the memo. Since moving to Arizona almost two decades ago, the Cardinals have been to the playoffs only once. But just as pigs began flying and Hades was freezing over, the Redbirds seemed on the cusp of changing their fortune. The team was moving into a new stadium, a true vision in the desert. Successful companies wanted to give the Cardinals huge amounts of money to put their names on the stadium.
We have a 20-year agreement with the Apollo Group to name the stadium, the University of Phoenix Stadium. A big piece, as I think everybody knows, of stadium economics in terms of revenues for professional teams. This revenue is going to help us go out there and compete.
Team Vice President Michael Bidwell is the son of Cardinals owner Bill Bidwell, who himself inherited the team from his parents. In addition to being inept, the Cardinals were also considered cheap, but that too was going to change with new stadium revenue. Coach Dennis Green raved this summer about the team's big splash in free agency, landing All-Pro running back Edgerrin James.
We feel that we have an offense that really needs that one thing, which is Edgerrin James, to make it really one of the very best in the entire National Football League. And that really becomes a question. Are you guys going to be good? And we resoundingly say, yes, we're going to be good.
James made it clear that he was a believer, too.
They said they're going to do what it takes to start winning, you know, and that's one thing. When I saw Coach Green, I went to him and I said, we got this thing we call Victory Mondays. I said, if we win on Monday, do we get that day off? And he didn't turn it down.
Maybe Green agreed and knew he wouldn't have to grant too many of those Victory Mondays. But the hiring of Green was also supposed to change the Cardinals' fortunes. He had learned coaching as an assistant under legendary San Francisco 49ers head coach Bill Walsh, and he'd taken the Minnesota Vikings to the playoffs in 8 of his 10 seasons in the Twin Cities. Bob Kemp is a former national talk host who now does his sports call-in show from Phoenix.
I don't know if it's jinx or whatever, but it is interesting how people that were smart other places seemingly get stupid when they come here.
Kemp says a lot of people in the Cardinals organization believe the new stadium could be the magic that would overcome the bad decisions and bad luck of the past.
Having moved into the new place, which I think some people, maybe even players, thought, hey, automatically we're going to win games because we have a new place and it's we're gonna have our fans there.
Those fans are already fed up, as a sample of Kemp's callers indicates.
Ridiculous call throughout that last time out before the field goal. You know you're going to get the ball back with a buck and change. It's ridiculous. It seems like we're having the same problem every year. It just seems like the way they lose, impossible. I mean, these are things that happen to the Cardinals.
Play clock winding down, operating out of the shotgun. Here comes the rush. Line handles it, looking long. Line it, airs it out. And caught! Touchdown! Strikes first, and Leinart with a big pass. Matt Leinart, welcome to the NFL.
The one lucky charm the Cardinals still have is quarterback Matt Leinart, the former Heisman Trophy winner from the University of Southern California. He was the team's first-round draft pick last April and wasn't supposed to play this year. That is, not until veteran signal caller Kurt Warner fumbled away a game in the closing seconds on October 1st versus the Atlanta Falcons.
I just fumbled it. You know, had a chance to win the game and cost us this football game.
I don't think I've been more angry since I've been here. And I've had some bad days since I've been here, believe me. But none of them compared to today.
Leinart is expected to lead the Cardinals to success, just like he did in leading USC to two national championships. But he'll have to be extremely lucky and quick, because a new stadium is only new for a short time. Again, Bob Kemp.
I think they have a grace period for next year, too, only because the Super Bowl is here. And then after that, you know, if they crap out this year and by 08, I think the good seats will be available.
No seats, good or otherwise, are available for the Cardinals' next home game. In the team's first appearance on a Monday night in more than a decade, Arizona will host the undefeated Chicago Bears. Oh, well, that's the Cardinals' luck again. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, I'll kick back with an unlikely kicker. But first, as the University of New Hampshire's football team prepared to host the University of Richmond in Durham last weekend, it was apparent that the atmosphere around the Division I AA team had changed since the days when a lot of people didn't know the school had a football team. At least it was apparent to Tim O'Sullivan, who writes about the UNH team for the Concord Monitor.
The fact that it took me 45 minutes to go about a mile and a half off the exit of the highway to the parking lot shows you that, you know, there's a lot of people coming from all over the state because, I think the locals take the back roads. You know, I think the word is getting out. People are curious, you know, who is this Ricky Santos? Who is this guy David Ball who's chasing down Jerry Rice? Are you kidding me? This is happening in New Hampshire? Let's go check it out.
For the record, this Ricky Santos, New Hampshire's all-time completion leader, is the quarterback of the team that beat Atlantic 10 conference rival Richmond 27-17 on Saturday. During that win, which pushed UNH to 5-0 on the season, this guy, David Ball, caught the 51st touchdown pass of his college career, one more than the end who'd previously held the Division I AA record, somebody named Jerry Rice. That's the kind of headlining achievement that drew Steve Caluso, who played football for New Hampshire several decades ago, back to the Durham Gridiron, where he says things were different when he played.
When we played, the only ones that were here were your wife, your girlfriend, or your mother and father. That's about it.
This despite the fact that the 1962 team for which Steve Caluso played was an undefeated conference champion. But these days, New Hampshire is not only knocking off teams like Richmond, Stony Brook, and Delaware. In their season opener, the Wildcats crushed Division I Northwestern 34-17. Before practice on Wednesday, I asked David Ball, the record-setting pass catcher himself, whether New Hampshire would next be scheduling Ohio State and Notre Dame.
I don't think so. You know, I think it's definitely something where I think 1AA is getting a lot of respect, especially, you know, UNH. You know, we've won two out of our last three 1A games against good opponents, and, you know, it's something that I think people are going to have to, you know, take us a little bit more serious.
Ball, a senior, hopes that at least one National Football League team will take him seriously because he'd very much like to continue playing after this season ends, But if that doesn't happen, he won't be at a loss. He has a backup plan.
I'm going to be an elementary gym teacher. I've always wanted to work with little kids. That was, you know, what I wanted to do when I came in. So, you know, I'll be fine with whatever happens, you know, as long as I'm still involved with athletics.
My time with David Ball, the poster boy for the New Hampshire team, was limited. The sports information director was hustling him out to the field for the umpteenth television interview to which Ball had agreed since becoming the most prolific pass catcher in the history of Division I AA football. The celebrity that Ball, and to a lesser extent his teammates, have achieved made me wonder how successful Coach Sean McDonnell had been in making sure these stars remember that they're students.
Well, I think at UNH, the kind of kids that we attract, and again, it goes back to our admissions office, and it goes back to the people that they let us recruit, and we don't get a whole lot of gifts here if we get any.
Doing okay in terms of everybody remembering to go to class and stay eligible and full roster?
We're working on it. We're doing okay. You know, and again, that's always a work in progress. You know, not to say that we don't have a couple sheep to get away from the flock every so often, but I'm pretty proud of the fact that our kids are graduating, you know, at around an 85-86% graduation rate right now, and I think that speaks volume of the type of kid we have in this program.
Most of the players with whom I spoke sounded as if they'd accepted the program, as coaches are inclined to say. Defensive captain Corey Graham told me it was no problem being studious because he'd promised his grandmother that he would always take his studies seriously. Andrew Elwell, who stands 6'4 and weighs 280 pounds, says he wants to be a high school history teacher, and he knows he'll need that degree. But Nick Couturier, the 6'1, 290-pound defensive lineman from Dover, New Hampshire, acknowledged that figuring out whether he's a football player coincidentally attending college or a student who happens to play football has been a challenge this season.
I focus on my education very hard, but I'd rather be known as a football player around here because it's starting to become a better place to be a football player.
What does that mean? What are the benefits?
Well, there aren't any benefits, but people are starting to understand that, like, we're a good team, and that, you know, I go downtown and people will go, oh, good game this weekend, and I turn to my friends and I'm like, I have no idea who that is. And it never really happened before, you know, this year and last year. It's a good feeling.
Couturier, who used to attend University of New Hampshire football games as a child, says he never imagined that anybody on the team in Durham would be mentioned in the same breath as Jerry Rice, perhaps the greatest receiver ever to catch a pass in the NFL, or that the Wildcats would be featured on ESPN.
To be honest, no. You know, I just watched them. You know, they played tough games. They're a physical team, and I never expected to be actually nationally ranked or being, you know, Rutgers or the Northwesterns of the world.
Nationally ranked, as in ranked number one among Division I AA teams, though quarterback Ricky Santos says neither he nor any of his teammates will take that distinction too seriously at the halfway point of their season.
It's so easy for us to look at the polls and say we're number one and stick our chest out and all that stuff and say we're great, but you know what, no one looks at it like that, and Coach Mack, frankly, he won't let us look at it like that, and it won't happen with him.
Maybe not, but is it safe to assume that having built this juggernaut that is the New Hampshire team, Coach Mack, who played for the Wildcats himself when they were not nearly so well known, will be satisfied to remain in Durham, where football has always been second to ice hockey at best? Coach says nobody at UNH has to worry about that.
We're going to be all right here. You know, we'll be fine. I think Durham's going to be a good place for Sean McDonald to be for a long time.
Coach McDonnell and his We're Number One record-breaking Division I squad-beating UNH team will try to run their record to 6-0 at noon today when the team from James Madison University visits Durham. If you're a technophobe like me, you may wonder what a podcast is. Let's consult the dictionary. Pod, a school of marine mammals, such as seals, whales, or dolphins. Cast, to throw with force or hurl. So if you'd like to throw dolphins with force, hurl whales, or listen to all of Only a Game's weekly offerings, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. One day while contemplating the book he was planning to write about the adventures and calamities of a collection of football players, Mark St. Amant asked himself, why just sit on the sidelines and watch semi-pro football when I can actually be part of a season? Therein was born a tale, as they say. The tale of number 6, St. Amant, kicker for the Boston Panthers, which is titled Just Kick It.
kicker and author Mark St. Amant joins me now in the studio. Mark, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
How did you first become acquainted with the Boston Panthers?
Well, I started looking into doing some research on my second book, a follow-up to my fantasy football book, and my agent and I wanted to stay in sort of the sports realm, and I started coming across semi-pro football more and more, and I didn't, like many people, I didn't know much about it. And I started researching in the Boston area, and I came across a team called the Boston Panthers, got in touch with their general manager, a guy named Reggie Murphy. At the time, I thought that I was just going to interview him and sort of watch from the stands. And over the course of interviewing him, I mentioned that I had played soccer in college, and out of the blue, he says, well, we need a kicker. You want to come out?
All right. An honest answer now. You meet this guy, Reggie. You tell him that you were a college soccer player. You had to be assuming you'd be offered the opportunity to demonstrate you could kick a football, too.
Had no idea. Had no earthly idea. I swear to God, it did not even cross my mind that I would end up joining the team. But Reggie said, well, if you're coming out, why don't you take a few kicks?
And bring your shoes.
I didn't bring my cleats. I did my first kicks in tennis shoes and had a very, very noticeable wipeout on my first kick, so that was an inauspicious beginning. So,
the way I read your story, your first triumph came in the locker room at the very first practice that you attended. You write, tucked away in the far corner, I began to get undressed, and no one told me to get the hell out. So that's when you knew you belonged.
That was a good start. You know, what I quickly discovered with the Panthers was, even though I was the most outside of outsiders, you know, suburban raised prep school boy, you know, the poster child for suburban white boy, and this is an inner city team based here in Dorchester, Roxbury. They didn't care, you know, it's the old cliche, black, white, yellow, green. They did not care as long as I loved football and could help the team.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You write that the whole experience of playing with the Panthers changed you. How so?
Well, what it really did was expand my boundaries within Boston, and I suddenly found myself in some of these previously forbidden neighborhoods and getting to know these people and getting to know the neighborhoods. And what I found was there's just a whole another vibrant area of Boston that I had never even dreamed of visiting before. So it really just expanded my boundaries within Boston.
That sounds very positive, but I would submit that not all of the changes in you, perhaps not all of them were improvements. What were you doing shrieking vile insults at the officials and expressing outrage at your own coach for not putting you in the game?
That was another transformation. You're right. You know, I had never been a really, really serious, ultra-serious athlete. You know, I had played sports and played it fairly well, but I had never been very, very competitive, and this sport and this team just brought something out in me that I hated to lose. I hated to think that I would contribute to a loss, and I hated when the refs especially got in the way of a win. And one time when I thought that we should have gone for an easy field goal, and instead they went for it on fourth down, I don't know, I was possessed by the devil. Something just snapped in me, and I found myself yelling up to our offensive coordinator, what the hell are you doing? We got to take the points there, et cetera. And he was looking down at me like, quiet.
Shut up, yeah. He explained.
Shut up, yeah. Yeah, he was like, shut up, let me call the plays. So,
among the more bizarre features of one of your teammates was a pair of fur-covered cleats and another pair of football shoes that sparkled and winked like a disco ball. What was that all about?
That was my my holder, Donnie Williams, who was the senior citizen on the team. He was, at the time, 42 years old. He's now our head coach, but in the 2004 season, which I write about, he was my holder. He's an eccentric character, really great guy, very funny guy. And one of his little trademarks was he had two special pairs of cleats that were stolen from Joe Namath's closet, clearly. You know, one was, like you said, this fur-covered pair of cleats, and the other one was this sequin-covered sparkly pair of cleats that, I mean, this is a guy who's probably 240 pounds, menacing-looking guy, and he's wearing these dainty little fur-covered cleats. And, you know, a lot of times it distracted my kicks because I would find myself, you know, the stadium lights glaring off the disco ball cleats as I try to kick.
That's as good an excuse as any, I
should
think.
Yeah, no doubt.
Did any of your teammates frighten you?
No, I wouldn't say frightened. There were, because like I said, they were just very welcoming from the start. But I will say there were a couple who were serious enigmas. The primary player who I really had a hard time cracking was this player, Pee-wee. And as the nickname implies, he was anything but Pee-wee.
I'm sure not.
He is something like the from the cover of a fitness magazine. And very quiet guy, stoic, but he would occasionally drop these little hints of what he had maybe gone through in his life because he knew I was writing a book on the team, and he would throw these little nuggets of information at me. And you know, I didn't want to run up to these guys with a notebook and pen and shove a tape recorder in their face. But, hey, tell me about your life. But over time, I ended up learning all about this guy, and he spent 9 years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until literally the last day before I had to send the final manuscript to my editor where I finally said, look, I got to get this because without knowing the true story behind Pee-wee, it's not going to be as good a book and I'm not going to feel as close to the team. And I had been putting it off, and he just said, all right, give me a call. Let's talk. So long answer, but I wouldn't say I was afraid of him, but there was certainly some hesitation in approaching some of these guys and as sort of the writer because, as Donnie said, Donnie's from Virginia, and he's got a great southern drawl, and his jokes are always fantastic. And he said, he's like, Mark, if there are two types of people that the black man does not trust, it's the white man and writers, and you are both. And that pretty much summed it up. So I knew I was starting from behind if that was the attitude.
Just out of curiosity, how many of the rest of the Panthers had spent time in jail?
Let's see. Of the probably 50 or so core players who were there predominantly, I would say 30% perhaps have spent, whether it's a night in jail, a time in lockup, or a longer stretch. It's these are guys who they're admittedly no angels. You know, they've made mistakes and done things wrong in the past, but I think one of the things I enjoyed about the book is showing how they've used football to move beyond that and correct some of those mistakes and try to teach the younger generations, look, you can, if you make some mistakes, you can move forward and move on with your life.
My guest is Mark St. Amant, author of Just Kick It. You're listening to Only a Game. The Panthers won more often than they lost, and the team made the playoffs your first year, the year that you write about. But some of the players on the other teams in the league still regarded the Panthers as a joke, and I'm quoting here. Why was that?
Well, I think there was the stereotype that we were thug athletes from the hood. And, I mean, it sounds funny me saying that, but, you know, that was
thug athletes from the hood, except for you.
Right, the hood of Beacon Hill, you know. While there were African-American players on other teams, certainly the Panthers were and are the only predominantly black and Latino team. And I think with that came a stereotype of they can't control themselves during games. They get in fights. So the way to beat them is to provoke them and get inside their heads. And while that was true to an extent, because, like I said, there were fights in the semi-pros, and we started and got into our share. But the rest of the league did have that perception of us, sure.
I can see why you might have thought it was a good idea to play one season with the Panthers to get a book out of it, sort of the way George Plimpton regarded his athletic adventures. But why are you still playing?
It's a good question. It just stuck with me. You know, I'd always been a football fan, watched football, was a big Patriots fan, am a big Patriots fan. But obviously, I'd never played before, and the second I got on the field, like we talked about earlier, something just sort of snapped and changed inside of me, and it stuck with me, and I got to know these guys, and I found in the offseason I missed them. So while I did think that it was going to be a one-season sort of literary experiment, I found out that it worked out. I enjoyed it. They liked having me, and I kept going.
Mark St. Amant, number 6 in your Panther program, assuming the Panthers have a program, is the author of Just Kick It, Tales of an Underdog, Overage, Out-of-Place Semi-Pro Football Player, published by Scribner. He joined me right here in the studios of WBUR in Boston. Mark, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Bill.
For more on this week's stories, links to a panoply of podcasts, or a look at our most recent photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a contest to put a fire in your belly, as the coaches like to say. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The biggest sports story of the week involved a plane crash, and the morbid fascination with Corey Lytle's death has resulted in some unusual, if not entirely unexpected, consequences.
This seems incredibly crass to bring up in the context of what is really kind of a bolt from the blue tragedy. But, you know, Bill, we really do suck as a nation
sometimes.
His autographed baseball on eBay sold for $15, and not a minute after an auction closed, another Corey Lytle autographed baseball went sailing up to $318. Now, I mean, there's profiting from death, and there's profiting from death, but there is also having a little bit of shame and a little bit of decency. I don't know what this says about us, but it's nothing good.
There has been a lot of talk this postseason about very young pitchers, Charlie, and so perhaps it's ironic that the star of the first game of the National League Championship Series was a very old pitcher.
Well, you don't mess with the former hockey guys when they get along in years. You know, they can still play. Yeah, any thinking human being is rooting for a World Series between the Detroit Tigers and the New York Mets. Why? Because if Detroit makes it, that means we don't have to listen to what a genius Billy Beane is. And if the Mets make it, that means we don't have to listen to what a genius Tony La Russa is. And given all of that, you've got a very likable bunch in Detroit who are young. You've got a very likable bunch in New York who are both young and old and giving us a World Series that's in New York but not at Yankee Stadium, which is a great thing. Tom Glavine came out and pitched a great game in the first game of the National League Championship Series. And Carlos Beltran is awake and playing baseball very well again.
Here's a baseball trivia question for you, Charlie. What time will Chicago White Sox night games begin next season, and why?
Because the entire world is a Slurpee. They will begin at 7-Eleven. Why? Because it's a sponsorship deal with a convenience store chain that is not Little Peach. This is fine. I mean, selling, you know, you can sell everything else. Why not sell a starting time? I'm just glad they didn't sell it to some auto parts store that had, like, 1040 oil or something like that.
In football news, Terrell Owens was observed screaming, quote, "Why am I here?" on the sideline while the Cowboys were playing the Eagles last weekend. Did he mean that in a cosmic sense?
Why am I here? What is reality?
What is reality?
You're here to catch passes. You're just not catching them because your quarterback keeps throwing it to the other team, T.O. Get used to it. You've played yourself out of every other place you are. Why are you here? Because you're not there anymore.
Republican Sandy Sullivan is running for Wisconsin Secretary of State. What exactly is her platform?
Her platform is she used to do the power sweep with the old Green Bay Packers.
See, I expected you'd say her platform was a waterbed, but I guess
she actually, well, I don't know if they had them in the mid-60s, did they? She is running, at least in part, embracing a memoir she wrote 2 years ago about being essentially a football Annie for the glory days of the Lombardi Packers in the 1960s. Now, she's running against a guy named La Follette, which means she has absolutely no chance of winning anything in Wisconsin. But she does get an enormous amount of credit for being quoted, "Remember, the 60s were the dawning of the age of Aquarius, and some women and the football players loved it." Now, this is the first time the phrase "age of Aquarius" has appeared in any political context in 40 years. And good for her, says I.
In college football, Louisville and Cincinnati will face each other at noon today, and the stakes are high.
The annual Keganails. They're going to play for the Keganails. What's the Keganails?
I don't know.
Who the heck knows? It's a trophy. But the Cardinals have won 6 of the last 7 kegs, so they can build a house and probably put up a barn out in back.
All right, what about other college football games that we should be paying attention to?
Well, the big one is Florida and Auburn. This is the Florida has now risen to be number 2 in most polls. They're going to Auburn. Auburn lost that last week. If Auburn beats Florida, it pretty much guarantees that everybody in the SEC is going to finish the season with at least one loss, which means the fight to play Ohio State who probably will finish the season undefeated in the Bowl Championship Series championship game, will be up between Southern Cal and whoever survives in the SEC, with West Virginia, unfortunately, being the odd team out.
Wisconsin will apparently have to play without musical accompaniment. How come?
Well, something happened during a trip to Michigan last month that was either boorish and offensive or patently dangerous and unlawful, which appears to be the bracket for band misbehavior. And they're going to replace the leadership of the band if there are any more reports of, quote, gratuitous vulgarity, sexualized banter or joking, hazing, or other forms of demeaning conduct. You mean being a tuba player isn't demeaning conduct enough?
On Thursday, Floyd Landis posted on his website his defense against charges that he was doping when he won the Tour de France. What do you think about Landis' strategy of making his entire defense open to anybody who has a computer?
Well, I mean, it's a compelling political move because the process of testing by which Floyd Landis has been hung out to dry in public is so secretive and hard to understand and closely held to the vest. Again, this is going to stagger on. There are inconsistencies with the lab. The labs say they're doing fine. The people on the other side are saying it's premature to comment. They will get around to it sooner or later, I'm sure.
Steven Jackson's behavior outside an Indianapolis strip club has been classified as criminal by the police. So far, the Pacers, for whom Mr. Jackson plays basketball, with the exception of Mr. Pacer himself, Reggie Miller, are defending him. Whose side are you on?
Well, Bill, back in the day, my old pappy said to me, son, there are only two rules in life. Nothing good can happen at a strip club at 3 o'clock in the morning, and nothing good can happen at a strip club at 3 o'clock in the morning if you start shooting off a gun. So I tend to be on Reggie
Miller. Your pappy was a wise man.
I've taken that advice to heart, and I'm on Reggie Miller's side on this one.
In a move that may or may not be related, the NBA is apparently instituting a new, quote, no-tolerance policy this season. What is the league unwilling to tolerate now?
It's unwilling to tolerate the 15-minute condensed German opera we get every time somebody doesn't like a call. Now, to me, the league would be much better served to take the egomaniacs out of its officiating crew so that these outbursts are not prompted. That said, people are sort of designing these little performances now, and I think it's time to rein them in a little bit.
The country of Israel now boasts its first official horse racing venue, Charlie. $20 million hippodrome seats several thousand people for races as well as equestrian shows, but the facility lacks one amenity, which is almost always found at this sort of place. What would that be?
Look, how many times have you heard people say they go to the track just to watch the horses and the gambling isn't part of it, right?
Right.
People say the same thing about the National Football League. However, the track in Israel, you are not allowed to bet on the race. You have to go there and watch the pretty horses run around the track. This is already being considered kind of a shaky economic model, and there are proposals to put in the $2 window.
I can just imagine the conversations there. I think that horse is going to win. No, I believe it will be that one. Let's watch and
I can
see.
Just imagine the odd phenomenon of 5 minutes before each race, the entire grandstand disappearing into the men's and ladies' room so as to conduct surreptitious wagering.
Charlie Fierce, the author of the soon-to-be-released Moving the Chains, Tom Brady, and the Pursuit of Everything, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Chili cooks from across the nation and beyond descended on Omaha, Nebraska last weekend to battle it out for the right to be called world's champion. For 40 years, the International Chili Society has brought together chili connoisseurs to compete for prestige, bragging rights, and thousands of dollars in prize money. As Nebraska Public Radio's Martin Wells reports from Omaha, some like it hot.
Bonnie Tomasek has been cooking competition chili for 20 years. She says she started because she didn't like her husband's cooking and thought she could do better.
All right, this is jungle green chili. I am a Colorado cook. Colorado is the home of green chili. It's one of our major crops. It's one of our native dishes, also New Mexico. You'll get this dish served to you in New Mexico and Colorado. So this is a very authentic one. It's very hot. This is the People's Choice green chili that I'm serving now. What I turn into the judges is not going to be as hot because they can't handle it.
Not all chili is hot, though many cooks like to play up that factor, like Dave Schulman of Avon, Connecticut. Schulman named his chili No Antidote. His booth features a banner with a red-eyed skeleton and a chef's hat stirring a steaming black cauldron. But Schulman says despite that, people shouldn't be scared off.
I think there's a general perception that chili is like blazing hot, and good chili is not blazing hot. It's spicy, but it's not, you know, it's not supposed to hurt you. But a lot of people don't know that, so it's fun to, you know, play to the prejudices, so to speak.
So what makes a world champion chili? Fred Whelan of Pahrump, Nevada knows. He's been the chief judge of the contest for the past 15 years.
Four things that I look for: a good heat in the back of the throat. I like a good cumin level. That's the dominant spice in chili. I like a nice garlic aftertaste without actually being able to taste the garlic. It's just the effect that it has. And I like the right amount of salt. That brings everything up. If a bowl has those in correct balance, they're probably going to win.
It's Whelan's responsibility to instruct the other judges on the six guidelines for award-winning chili.
Good flavoring, chili pepper taste, not too hot or mild. The texture of the meat, not too tough or mushy. Consistency, not too thick or thin. The blend of the spices and how well they have permeated the meat. Aroma, usually a personal preference, and color. And that's all I tell them. If they can't figure it out without, they're in serious trouble.
As Whelan is constantly reminding everyone, the event is really about having fun.
After I have my cooks meeting, I tell all the cooks, if you don't have a good time today, it's your own damn fault.
One group that has taken that advice to heart is the Coconut Girls. Their Hawaiian-themed booth and coconut-top T-shirts indicate they're from the islands of Aberdeen, South Dakota. Mary Musil is the group's leader.
We were nurses that worked in the intensive care unit together and working a night shift and decided, hey, what can we do different than we did the last time for our booth that would, like, bring people in? And this is it. Tops with coconuts on it and grass skirts and the whole Hawaiian theme, and it's kind of gone from there, and we've had a great time with it since.
This is the Coconut Girls' first trip to the World's Championship, and like most cooks, Musil is not about to give away her secrets.
I can't tell you the rest or I'd have to kill you. And then we'd resuscitate you.
Yeah.
And bring you back for more.
Showmanship seems to be as important to these chili cooks as the product itself. Debbie Turner of Waxahachie, Texas, says it's a tradition born in the early days of chili cook-offs back in the 1960s.
It wasn't just cooking your chili, it was barking the public in, because in the early days it was the judges walked around to the booths and tasted the chili, and the people tried to convince the judges verbally, you know, with all this stuff, that I'm the best. So we kind of harken back to the old days.
Debbie is the cook, while her husband Wayne is the barker. He's quick to play up his wife's chili and play down the competition.
They're not from Texas. You got to understand. I mean, we're proud of our state and proud of our product. It's our state dish. And she is even the advisor to Governor Perry, chili advisor to Governor Perry for the state.
The main event of the weekend is the grand prize for traditional red, awarded on Sunday night. This year, the event is tinged with sadness due to the impending retirement of Chief Judge Fred Whelan and his wife, Leah. International Chili Society CEO Carol Hancock chokes up while paying tribute to the Whelans.
And you know what? There isn't enough things for us to say. But what we're going to say is, you know what, Fred and Leah? if you didn't have a good time for the past 10, 15 years, it's your own damn fault.
And then the moment everyone is waiting for.
And the envelope, please. The 40th anniversary of the International Chili Society's World Championship Chili Cook-Off. Your 2006 World Champion, well-deserved, is J.R. Knutson.
90-year-old J.R. Knutson, dressed in a red apron and straw hat, looks stunned as the announcement is made. He's quickly mobbed by his fellow cooks and led up on stage.
Needless to say, this is a surprise for me. you know, I had no idea I was even going to come close. I would have bet that I didn't even make the final table.
For his award-winning traditional red chili, Knutson received a check from the International Chili Society for $25,000, along with an additional $5,000 from the cook-off's main sponsor, not to mention bragging rights for the next year. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Wells in Omaha, Nebraska.
That's where the people's choice
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Elias Feldman and from Dan Gorenstein at New Hampshire Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Martin Wells' 7-alarm chili cook-off photo gallery, learn more about Just Kick It, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from 82-year-old Boston Globe columnist Donald Murray, who expounds on the nature of football.
I love football. I played it, but it's a violent game. I say to my liberal friends who won't go, and I say, well, it's like being, I'm against capital punishment, but give me a good hanging, I'll be there.
Oh, man, are they hanging football players now? I didn't think it could get any worse. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR.